So anyway, we're glad you're here and hope you enjoy some enlightenment tonight. Tonight our speaker is Reg Grant, who's a professor at Dallas Seminary. Reg is Lauren's husband. They have three grown children, Rosalind, Gabe, and Nick. Reg serves as chair of the Department of Media Arts and Worship at Dallas Theological Seminary, where he teaches courses in preaching and drama, voice, creative writing, and creative audio production. He serves on the board of Insight for Living. Probably most of the people in this room are aware of that, but Chuck Swindoll, who preaches in Frisco, I think, has set up that ministry. He's authored several books and articles and has written and acted for radio, television, theater, and film. Several of his films have been nominated for Emmys, and two have won, and two have received the Golden Apple Award for Best Educational Film in America. And Lauren serves as a children's advocate for CASA, which is, I think that has to do with family court or something.
Yes, court-appointed special advocate for children.
Yeah, for children, okay. So anyway, with that, Reg is going to speak to us about Kant tonight, which I think is going to be quite interesting. So would you please welcome Reg Grant.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good to see you all. I've been looking forward to this for 6 months. Ken invited me about 6 months ago, and it had been, I'd say about 30 years since I had studied Kant. And I thought, well, I've been fascinated with him for a long time, and this is a good opportunity to dive back in. And so for the last six and a half months, I have been rereading the First Critique, mainly. And I am just impressed all over again with the depth and the insights of this man. I am going to bring you believe it or not, Dallas Theological Seminary, I'm going to bring you basically a positive reading of Kant. There are going to be some issues that I have with the gentleman, far be it from me to ever have to face him, but I will try to articulate those. I'm going to be quoting heavily from a couple of men, one in particular, Dan Robinson. Is anybody in here familiar with Dr. Robinson? He is a distinguished professor emeritus of philosophy at Georgetown and a fellow on the faculty of philosophy at Oxford. He has a course that I have attended in a way. Thinking of everything in Kantian terms now. Attended is a technical term for what I did with his course. Not there physically, but I attended in the sense of engaging with a representation of Dr. Robinson via iTunes University. He has the entire, if you have not accessed iTunes in philosophy, there are some amazing lectures available.
Did he teach a company course too?
Yeah, he did. He did. Sure did. Yeah. I have that. Dr. Robinson is, if anybody in this world looks like a Kantian scholar, it is Dan Robinson. He just full head of white hair, 74 years old, beautiful salt and pepper beard. Yeah, the guy really fits the archetype. And a very generous kind of a person. I found him to be very good. The other person is Carl Amricks. If you're familiar with Dr. Amricks, probably he's the McMahon-Hanks Professor of Philosophy at Notre Dame and is probably the leading Kant scholar. I mean, in the United States anyway, maybe in Europe as well. These gentlemen have opened my eyes to a bit of a new view of Kant. I'm going to start with four quotes from Kant, and then we're going to define some terms so that we're sure we're all on the same page, and then we are going to suggest an alternative, a response to the subject at hand. The subject is Kant's categorical imperative. Is it moral? Is it an imperative, and where does it come from? Kant's categorical imperative. Is it moral? Is it an imperative? And where does it come from? These are the quotes from Kant. These are all from the First Critique. Thus, says Kant, while all the ambitious attempts of reason to penetrate beyond the limits of experience end in disappointment, there is still enough left to satisfy us in a practical point of view. Now, bear in mind, what he's doing here is he's laying the groundwork for the Second Critique, the Critique of Practical Reason, where he lays out his moral philosophy. So everything, I didn't even know that when I started 6 months ago. I didn't know that the First Critique was really a springboard into the second, into the Practical Critique. So when he says practical point of view, what he's doing is he's laying that groundwork. No one, it is true, will be able to boast that he knows that there is a God and a future life. For if he knows this, he is just the man whom I have long wished to find. No, my conviction, his conviction concerning the existence of God, that's what he's talking about. My conviction is not logical, First Critique, but moral, Second Critique. Certainty. Not logical, but moral certainty. Interesting use of words there, choice of words. And since it rests on subjective grounds, or the moral sentiment, I must not even say it is morally certain that there is a God, etc., but that I am morally certain. That is, my belief in God and in another world is so interwoven with my moral nature that I am under as little apprehension of having the former torn from me as of losing the latter. That's in the First Critique. He's preparing you for his moral argument for the existence of God in the Second Critique. Quote number two. Can I turn this on, Ken?
Well, you can. I think it's...
Wow. That's great. Thank you. Second quote. A man who is entirely indifferent with regard to moral laws cannot pretend to any certainty of the non-existence of God and of a future life, unless, since it could only be proved by mere reason and therefore epideictically, that is evident beyond any contradiction, he is prepared to establish the impossibility of both, which certainly no reasonable man could undertake to do. This would be a negative belief, and Kant is against negative belief. So he's saying you can't deny the existence of God unless you're also willing to deny the non-existence of God through logical proof, and you can't do that. Third quote, since the moral precept is, notice how much emphasis there is in morals in the First Critique. I was shocked to learn that. But there's a great emphasis on moral qualities in the First Critique. Since the moral precept is at the same time my maxim, as reason requires that it should be, I am irresistibly constrained to believe in the existence of God and in a future life. I am sure, says Immanuel Kant, that nothing can make me waver in this belief, since I should thereby overthrow my moral maxims, the renunciation of which would make me hateful in my own eyes. Are you surprised by that? I was shocked to find that. I checked the translation. As far as I can tell, it's a good translation. Fourth and final, this is the most extended one. When I hear that the freedom of the will, the hope of a future life, and the existence of God have been overthrown by the arguments of some able writer, I feel a strong desire to read his book. For I expect that he will add to my knowledge and impart greater clearness and distinctness to my views by the argumentative power shown in his writings. But this is Kant having what is for Kant a little bit of fun. I am perfectly certain that even before I have opened the book, that he has not succeeded in a single point. Not because I believe I am in possession of irrefutable demonstrations of these important propositions, but he really was convinced that he was in possession of such demonstrations. But because this transcendental critique, which has disclosed to me the power and the limits of pure reason, has fully convinced me that, as it is insufficient to establish the affirmative, it is as powerless and even more so to assure us of the truth of the negative answer to these questions. Same thing he was saying up top, except expanded. You can't make a positive claim and a negative claim, unless you're willing to make the negative claim. From what source does this free thinker derive his knowledge that there is, for example, no supreme being? This proposition lies out of the field of possible experience, key word for Kant, possible experience, because you can't know, you can't have knowledge of anything apart from experience, and therefore beyond the limits of human cognition. Let me read that last sentence again. This proposition lies outside the field of possible experience. That's a point where I'm going to disagree. Outside the field of possible experience. Not outside the field of experience, outside the field of possible experience. And therefore, beyond the limits of human cognition. So what we have in Kant, at least to this point, is an admission that there is a moral premise that we might want to explore for a legitimate claim regarding the existence of God. And he's not talking at this point about Jesus, he's not talking about the Bible, he's just talking about a moral position vis-a-vis the existence of God. Now, when he gets into later writings, he will talk about Jesus, but he never uses his name. He calls him the Divine One, the One sent from God, but he never uses Jesus' name, although it's clear from the context that's who he's talking about. We'll get to that in just a few minutes. I want to get through this as quickly as I can so that we can talk, so that we can have some conversation here. So I'm hoping I don't get bogged down in all of the detail. And really, I'm scared about this because I don't know you. I don't know this audience. I don't know... If my vocabulary if it's unclear, then just stop me and I will try to clear it up. But because I'm using a lot of Kantian quotes and I'm using a lot of the stuff from Dan Robinson and those other guys. A concise definition of the categorical imperative. We have to start there. And we're mainly going to deal with the first formulation, not the second, not the third, which is tangential anyway. We're going to deal mainly with the first. The first formulation. The basis for his morals. In his book, Groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, Kant gives a succinct definition. There is, therefore, only a single categorical imperative, and it is this. This is a direct quote from Kant. Act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it become a universal law. Act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will that it become universal law. Let me take that apart just a little bit. A maxim is a generalized rule for acting in a certain way under certain set of circumstances. That's all a maxim is. The meaning of universal. A maxim is universalizable if we can will that everyone act in accordance with that maxim. In other words, it applies to all people of all time. It is transcendental. It is transcultural. It is transtemporal. This is a rule, a maxim that would apply to all people of all time, regardless of social station or education level or anything else. Number three, an illustration might be, for example, if you have an exam that you're going to take and you have a reason for cheating on that exam, then the moral restraint for not cheating would be called this. That would be a maxim that's universal. You have an immediate gain by cheating, but you buy into an idea that's bigger than the immediate gain you would get from cheating, and that maxim is it's wrong to cheat. So there is a morality against cheating that you would apply in that case. I'm going to try to help us here with a little bit of a distinction. What really makes the categorical imperative categorical as opposed to a different kind of imperative, which we might call a hypothetical imperative? Okay? The notion of a categorical imperative can be understood in contrast to hypothetical in this. The hypothetical imperative tells you what to do in order to achieve some goal. For example, if you want to get a good grade in English, then you need to study. If, then. Protestants, apostates. If you want to get a good grade in English, then you need to study. Hypothetical imperative. It tells you what to do in order to get a good grade, but it doesn't tell you what to do if you don't care about getting a good grade. That is where the categorical comes in. What is distinctive about the categorical imperatives is it tells you to act, tells you how to act regardless of what end or goal you might desire. Doesn't matter. It overrules your immediate desire to cheat on the test in order to get a good grade. Okay? Okay. Taking the fundamental principle of morality to be a categorical imperative implies that moral reasons override other sorts of reasons. And now this is from the first critique. Bear in mind, he's laying the groundwork for the moral critique that's to come later. You might, for instance, think you have a self-interest in cheating, but the moral imperative, the categorical imperative, says, no, you can't do that. It's wrong. Okay, those are the two basic differences. Okay, any questions so far on what constitutes the categorical imperative? Okay, yeah.
Besides the problematic hypothetical imperative, if then, there's an esoteric hypothetical imperative since then.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So that there is the esoteric, there is the since then, rather than the protestus apotestus if then. Right. Right. Okay. Okay. Let's forge ahead here. I do want to. I want to make you aware, but although we're not going to take it apart, I want to make you aware of the second formulation, just because it's sort of like when Jesus was asked, "What is the greatest commandment?" and he said. Remember what Jesus said when they said, what is the greatest commandment? What did he say? Love the Lord your God with all your heart. Right? And then the second is like it. Love your neighbor as yourself. So you've got vertical, you've got horizontal. That's basically what you have in the first two formulations. You've got a vertical, you've got a horizontal, because the second one is like unto the first. It is always treat persons, including yourselves, including yourself, as ends in themselves, never merely as a means to an end. This is the foundational element for his whole system of morals. If I go into the dry cleaners, this only goes so far, because it's possible for me to use someone as a means to an end and not violate the moral principle that Kant is espousing here. Like if Mitchell is a dry cleaner, I go into Mitchell and I say, I want you to dry clean my suit, please. Then unless I have a gun and saying, Mitchell, I want you to dry clean, he's going to do it. As long as it's volitional on his part and I'm not abusing the relationship by forcing him in some way to do my dry cleaning, that's fine. I'm using him as a means to an end, and it's not violating any kind of moral code. So that's okay. It only goes so far. You can't make it walk on all fours here. All right, that's basically the second formulation. Main point two, Kantian versus a more perhaps Christian reading of anthropology that's going to inform his epistemology, which is going to result in a whole philosophical system. Where we agree is on this point, that men, by nature, are radically evil. That's Kant. That we are radically evil, all have a propensity to immorality. Romans 3:23, I'm going to come back to the Bible again and again, not too much, I hope. But it is the basis for my own moral stance, my own moral posture. All men have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. Kant would have no problem with that. He would say that everybody is, in his words, radically evil. If you want to check it out in his work, Religion, the second piece, section 1, subsection B, there's a gentleman named Palmquist that I would refer you to who said this, in an article that he wrote not long ago called Could Kant's Jesus Be God? The first piece advanced a quasi-transcendental argument to establish that human beings are by nature radically evil. So that is an analysis of Kant's work in religion, and it's clear as a bell. There isn't any interpretation going on there. He regarded men as radically evil. There are indeed moral imperatives for those. The reason you come up with a categorical imperative is in order to, and this is really critical in Kant, it is in order to give the person the opportunity to correct himself or herself. It is not, it is recognizing from Kant's perspective the independence, the autonomy of the individual and self-correction. How does Jesus fit into this? Jesus, in Kant, is a morally perfect person. He is an archetype of the perfect, the ideal. I'll qualify that and make sure that we understand that Kant would never agree that he was an idealist except as a... the word is escaping me. As a... not a perceptual idealist. It'll come to me. There's a particular kind of idealism that Kant would allow for, but that's it. I'll have to...
Transcendental idealist.
A transcendental idealist, thank you. Transcendental idealist. He would agree to that. But what he means by transcendental is different than what we mean by transcendent. He would never buy into the transcendent as an object of knowledge. He would, however, establish an argument based on a transcendental ideal. Okay, all of that to say, there are moral imperatives for the Christian, but they are not Kantian. That is, they are not based anthropologically on an a priori concept of man as independent, autonomous, non-contingent being. Kant's moral imperative is, at its root, my interpretation, mechanical, despite his insistence on his critical analysis of dialectical logic, as that dialectical logic is an organon, over against Aristotle's formal analytic logic. Despite that, it is also reductionistic and, I think, imposed. The Christian imperative is based on an a priori concept of man as contingent. It is organic, it is holistic, and acknowledges the immaterial realities of soul, spirit, and the existence of God as reasonable.
And basically evil, original sin.
That what is...
And
what
basically is, evil.
What is basically...
Original sin.
Right, but what is originally, what is basically evil? The view of God is basically evil, or what is...
The concept of original sin in Genesis.
Yep, right, okay.
So it's the same thing. Man is basically evil.
Man is basically evil, okay, right. Right. It is anthropologically aware of its limitations, the Christian view, anthropologically aware of its limitations, and epistemologically conscious... Okay, this is the basic difference that I would have with Mr. Kant. Epistemologically conscious of the bridge to the absolute, which renders understanding of the noumenal possible. Not guarantees it, but renders it possible. If there's a bridge. If there's no bridge, then it's impossible. If there is a bridge, then it at least renders our conspiracy. It makes us consider the possibility of a knowledge of the absolute, a knowledge of the noumenal. This is the same as the difference, if any of you are trying to make some kind of a connection between Locke and Kant, this is the same as the difference between Locke's nominal essences, which equal Kant's phenomenal, and his real essences, which is Kant's noumenal. Point number three. Kantian versus Christian epistemology, where we agree. Now, there is so much literature regarding the epistemology of Kant. I realize that, and I am certainly no expert in this field, but there is a kernel at the base of this that I want to explore. Where we agree, there must be a unifying principle to make sense out of the sensuous manifold of experience. There must be an organizing principle. Otherwise, you wind up with Hume being saying, I'm nothing but a collection of percepts. I just have a bag of perceptions, and the ball hits, you know, the other balls on the table, and I see nothing in between. I strike, it hits, there's nothing in between. It's just a bag of perceptions. What is it that enables me to move from from perceiving this apparent relationship of cause and effect to being able to say, this is an experience that I can then think about and make a pronouncement regarding. There must be some unifying principle. Kant's epistemology, as far as I can trace it, takes you all the way down, and I forget which page it's on. It is way, way, way down in the first critique. He must have at its root faith in what he calls mother wit. It only occurs a couple of times in the first critique that I've been able to find. He argues that our senses, this is how he gets there. Mother wit. Now, mother wit is just throwing up your hands and saying, I don't know how we do it. I don't know how it happens. I don't know where the unifying principle comes from. Let's call it mother wit. Which, who is the great Scottish realist? My goodness.
Hugh?
No, Common Sense.
Reed.
Thomas Reed had a field day with mother wit. Kant's epistemology argues that our senses record, albeit subjectively, and therefore imperfectly, impressions. So the modern world, the world as it is, gives us this sense data, which generate impressions. Now there has to be a perceiver, there has to be something external to me in order to perceive impressions of the phenomenal world. Those impressions he terms appearances. Those appearances cohere through an exercise of, in Kant's words, the imagination, which houses mother wit. The imagination forms these impressions, these appearances, into concepts. And the concepts, interpreted by my mind, result in experiences. And my consideration of experiences result in reason as a vehicle for understanding. The multitude of impinging sensory data he terms, now this is all the stuff of life. It's the glass, it's your red shirt, it's the air conditioning. The multitude of impinging sensory data he terms the synthesis of the manifold experience. And the manifold is just all the stuff. Okay, the synthesis of the manifold experience is all this impinging data. And the transcendent... Okay, I know this is getting out there, and it's... Yeah, sorry. These are really critical concepts for Kant to get to this point where he has to throw up his hands and say, mother wit. The transcendental unity of apperception, okay? The transcendental unity of apperception refers to what are the necessary conditions for unification. The unification of elements of empirical apperception. That is, the stuff that I can see, smell, taste, touch, hear. These things that are gleaned by the senses and give rise to the sensations, and these sensations then are in the form of perceptions being subsumed under general categories. So they're all going to fit into... Kant has a mania for systematization. He would make the world's greatest librarian. He had a cubbyhole for every single thought, every jot and tittle. He could categorize. All this must be unified. It doesn't matter how many compartments you place it into. It has to be unified, or all you get is blue shirt, glasses, black coat. Ed? No. Blue. I would never come up with Ed. I'd never be able to see, never be able to say Ed. I couldn't put it all together. There has to be a unifying principle.
There was
a unifying principle.
Yes.
And it was.
And I was shocked to find it after 50 years. The unifying principle is do unto others as you would have them do unto you.
Second
and
formulation.
He says that once, only once. And that's the Christian formulation. The Hebrew formulation is don't do unto others as you would make them do unto you. Two different things. But that's his unifying principle. And when you boil it down, I think it's pretty simple. I think you can't find any moral definition or conception that is more solid than that.
What would you say is the locus of that do unto others as you would have them do unto you? Where is it located?
At the time, and this goes outside
of time. Microphone or
At the time, and this goes outside of time, there was a very strong feeling that was later blown apart by existentialists that if you didn't have a concept of God, and you didn't believe in God, you couldn't assure the moral conduct of man. That you needed the concept and belief in God in order to posit judgment and punishment in the afterlife. And of course, with Dostoevsky and the
writers
in the 19th
century. Concept's the same thing. It's third.
Yes, it is.
It is third.
And it's third. Well, and he hits on morals in the second, of course. So.
Yeah, and this, I found that in the Metaphysics of Morals. And I was surprised because I didn't remember it from 50 years ago.
Well, I want to talk to you after this about what he does with Mother Wit out of the first critique, how he deals with that in the second edition of the first. And he may deal with Mother Wit in the second edition of the first, because I was mainly in the first edition.
Right.
So let's talk about that. This has to be, let me see, where was I? Okay. The transcendental unity of apperception refers to what are finally necessary conditions for the unification of the various elements of the stuff, of this empirical apperception. But this must operate, this is an important part about Kant too, this must operate a priori as established by the fact that nothing at the level of appearances themselves contains within it the means by which to establish the means by which to obtain such unification. It's not in the stimulus. We bring it. Now, does this sound familiar? For those of you who like popular level physics, this sounds a lot to me. In other words, the organizational principle is not in the stimulus. It's not in the stuff of the world. I can only look and determine individual discrete parts. So it's not in there. It is in, it's in what I bring to it. So my perception of Ed may be different than Ken's perception of Ed because he occupies a different physical space. So what we bring to it is the it is akin, I think, to the point of view in quantum physics that as perceivers we render a difference. We make a difference in the outcome of what we perceive. What we bring to the table actually affects the outcome, the flow of electrons from point A to point B. Kant, that's what he's saying here. We bring this mind to our to the percepts. Yes.
Can I structure the world in a different way?
Oh, please.
Can I structure the world in a different way?
If sure.
I bring the order to things, then can I bring a different order?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I just look at you and suddenly become the wall.
Yeah, I could. And you have no basis for saying that I'm not. Or Ken has no basis for saying that I'm not. Because you're autonomous and you're coming to that of your own free will.
Well, we need to establish that. He says, Kant says that, right, but it seems to go against our common sense.
Yeah.
Behave as if you are stone or something. just because I unify things. I unify you into a stone.
Sure, yeah.
Can I do so? Would you agree with that?
Yeah, no, could not, no. I mean, Descartes, I mean, this is the whole part problem of the cogito. Remember what Reed said about Descartes? He said, a man who doubts his own existence isn't any more to be reasoned with than a man who believes he's glass. And I'm much more Reedian and even Barclayan to a certain extent. Yeah?
Henry, you're not becoming Bishop Barclay, I don't
know. No.
External reality.
Yes, there are external reality, but there are parts of Barclay that I really appreciate, and there are parts of Kant that I really appreciate, but I am not, no.
Yeah. Kant does talk about the categories of the mind, which are necessary in order to have experience at all mm-hmm. in the first place. Mm-hmm. That's what he's setting up here in order to come to his moral conclusions.
Yes.
They are innate. We are born
yes.
with.
And I'm trying to think of the right word. Innate is...
Inborn.
Yes.
A priori.
A priori and
yes.
Space and time as being necessary components of that a priori.
Without
it, you wouldn't have experience.
Right.
Necessary to have experience.
Right. Okay. Thank you, sir.
Comment.
Yes.
If you've ever had the experience of mistaking a mannequin for a person, or a person for a mannequin, you've just illustrated the possibility that yes, I could perceive you as part of a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Although you would correct that.
Yeah.
Why do you correct it? Mm-hmm. Why don't you go with that reality for the rest of your life?
After a while, when the law talks to me,
reality, right?
I conclude that, oh, I missed it. I know. I had an illusion.
Yeah. It's like that last scene in the latest Sherlock Holmes film where he's seated in the chair and he is dressed in camouflage to blend into the room, and Watson comes into the room and he looks right at the chair and he doesn't see Holmes until Watson leaves the room, and then Holmes, who everybody thinks is dead, moves. And then all of a sudden, what gives him the clue? Watson never did get the clue, but the viewer receives the clue from context. So the context that incorporates movement now separates it out and makes it helps us to adjust our point of view. What's required, Kant says, is an act of the imagination which is known not as a representation, but directly by way of the act itself. Quote, it is conscious to itself even without sensibility, close quote, even without sensibility, that you, as a conscious entity, are aware of these powers that you have is not something engaged by or triggered by the sensibility itself. It's not in the data. This is something that would be there whether or not sensibility was present. As this is a necessary and universal condition of experience itself, it is grounded in an a priori substrate, which Kant calls the transcendental ego, as opposed to the empirical ego, and we won't go there. The transcendental ego of Kant, according to one writer named James Van Cleve, he really gets into a lot of hot water with the last phrase of his analysis here. He says, the transcendental ego is the thinker of our thoughts, the subject of our experiences, the willer of our actions, and the agent of the various activities of synthesis that help to constitute the world we experience. Okay, good so far. But then he says this. It is probably to be identified with our real or noumenal self. Well, that creates problems if you're Kant or a Kantian scholar. You reject that. Robinson totally dismisses that idea. That any of all the former is true, but a connection with the noumenal self, with the real self, the thing in and of itself as it is not possible.
And that's what Kant said.
That's what Kant said, right. How Kant finally explained, I'm going to skip this part. The difference between, this is in Kant's Weltanschauung, this is how he understands the differences between what we say we believe, how we believe it. Having an opinion is taking something to be true with the consciousness that it is subjectively as well as objectively insufficient. I just have an opinion about it. I think the Rangers are a great baseball team. You may disagree. I will look to Adrian Beltre and say, no, you're wrong. It's based on his performance. I think he's good, but it's an opinion. It's all it is. Believing, number two, if taking something to be true is only subjectively sufficient and is at the same time held to be objectively insufficient, it is called believing. Subjectively sufficient and at the same time objectively insufficient. That's believing. Now, that starts getting a little bit closer to home. Three, knowing. Finally, when taking something to be true is both subjectively and objectively sufficient, it is called knowing. Every I dotted, every T crossed. Subjective sufficiency is called conviction for myself, and objective sufficiency is called certainty. That's for everybody. That's for everyone. Kant argues that those who use, now, I think that I will not get into his argument against the paralogisms because we don't have time to develop them, or the antinomies, which is really fascinating, except for the last antinomy, which is really great. The last antinomy is the theological antinomy, and we will get to that one. The mistake, according to Kant, of after he has dissembled the paralogisms and the antinomies is this. Such transcendental use of the understanding, independent of sensibility, is simply a mistake, says Kant. Generally, one of the illusions of reason, he's all for reason, but reason can lead you to convictions concerning things that are not real or not necessarily so. I can imagine a world, I can imagine Star Wars, but it's not real. It's a concept. I can conceive of it, but it's not real. So you have to rein in reason, according to Kant. It's simply a mistake. Generally, one of the illusions of reason, seeking knowledge of things, now remember, knowledge is an important word here. We just defined what knowledge was. Knowledge of things that are independent of experience. You can't really know anything apart from experience, says Kant. So seeking those things that are independent of experience is seeking noumena, and it's doomed to fail. And this includes the search for the noumenal self, as per Descartes and Leibniz. They confused the logical self of propositions with an ontological discovery of something. What the paralogisms make clear is that reason liberated from necessary discipline seeks to go beyond its own transcendental grounding to what is finally the transcendent. Now remember we said he will make a transcendental argument, but he will disabuse himself of any argument that says that we can arrive at a sure knowledge of the transcendent. And therein lies the illusion. If you want to go to heaven, this is a direct quote, I love this from Robinson. If you want to go to heaven, you will not do so by way of reason alone. True. You will not do so by way of understanding. I'm not sure I buy that. Nor will you do so by correctly subsuming the sensuous manifold correctly under the pure concepts of the understanding. So the way that you categorize it isn't going to get you to heaven. So what is left to you, I should think, is prayer, says Robinson. He should probably stay in philosophy and not venture into theology, because that's wrong. Christian epistemology. We know, all right, bottom line, we know because we are known. The way of knowing is through faith in the person of Jesus Christ according to the reliable record, my opinion, the reliable record of his death, burial, and resurrection in the scriptures. I have spent the last, well, since 1976, I guess, trying to, as objectively as I can, understand the and verify the authority of Scripture, of the Bible, as we have received it, as a reliable record. And I am convinced that it is roughly 99.5% pure as a record, as a reliable record. Now, whether or not you believe the record is up to you. But as a reliable record of a historical account written by many different witnesses, I think that it is reliable, and I can give you some more help there if you would be interested. Okay, here's the final point. The question, Kant's moral imperative. Is it moral? Is it imperative? Where does it come from? First, is the moral imperative moral? Yes, it's moral. Though its morality is based on looking to Jesus as a moral example, leaving the responsibility for living a consistently moral life in our court. Kant is, in this regard, Pelagian. He regards that Jesus is a moral example, a positive example to be followed, but nothing, but not more than that, in terms of how he functions to get us to live a good life. Yes, it is an imperative, but only relative to personal conviction, based on belief, which is by definition based on truth that is objectively insufficient, according to Kant. Where does it come from? Kant says, mother wit, although I'm hoping for correction for this reading. Now, this is a quote, the final quote from our friend Robinson. Now, how about deploying these sensuous resources correctly under the categories? This is the task of spontaneity. Whence spontaneity? It is guided by principles that Kant finally throws up his hands and refers to generically as mother wit. And so we are left with this problem. Since so much of this is done by a priori principles over which we certainly have no conscious control, does this not lead to a kind of skepticism and subjectivity? And of course, Kant has an answer for that. But that's where we will call it good. And let's open the floor if we have time. Do we have time, Ken?
Yes, I'm sure.
Some observations, questions, corrections, emendations. Yes.
I just wanted to point out, I was a professor of philosophy. I know Kant quite well. I just want to point out his purpose in philosophy was to bring together the two branches of philosophy from the very beginning, idealism and materialism, and he synthesized them. Mm. That was his purpose. He proved that, or he disproved all of the proofs of existence of God, St. Thomas Aquinas, not because he was an atheist or an agnostic. He was a very religious man. He was a pious man. But what he tried to do was show that you could not get to religion through reason. You had to use faith, which is pretty much what modern religion is telling us, modern Christianity.
But at the same time, I don't think that it is... I agree. I think that's my reading of Kant as well. What I question is whether or not it is you can't establish a right relationship with God, prove God through reason alone. Is it reasonable to suggest, and I'm really asking the question here, that if there is an experience that has been recorded, the way Kant defines experience, in the bridge, in the person of Jesus Christ as the bridge between the noumenal and the phenomenal, as a revealer of, this is the whole point of John 5, as a revealer of ultimate reality, so that John at the end of the Gospel could write, these things I write to you that you may know, then would that expand our understanding perhaps, or challenge his claim that it's not that it's not by reason, I understand it's not by reason, but that it's reasonable to suggest that there is a viable link in the person of Christ, only in him as a revealer of the noumenal.
Not necessarily, because it's still a matter of faith. You have to take on faith that Jesus was, you know, the revealer. And, I'm not even sure that Jesus even lived.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
On the question of where it comes from, there's a famous Kant quote, I'm not going to get it quite right, but it's something like, there's two things I'm in awe of, the starry heavens above and the moral sense within, or something like that. And so I would wonder if he wouldn't say that, you know, where it comes from is this sort of moral compass, this sort of, you know.
Oh, I think he would. Anyway. Yeah, and that's in the second critique. That this inter... Go ahead.
See, you got to go back to the original thing. He's making two different worlds, a noumenal world and a phenomenal world.
Right.
And he says you cannot know. There is no knowledge of the noumenal world. And all religion ends up in the noumenal world. In the practical world, you have direct empirical experience. And I know the chair, and I know Jack, and I know this, and I know that.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes back again to basic Protestantism and Catholicism too. It's a matter of faith.
Well,
and that's what he's trying to point out. You can't use reason for religion.
That's the reason that Christ was crucified physically. It's something that you could point to. And the reason that he appeared to 500 people in the flesh to make up for that part. That you have to, that's the phenomenal, or the part that we need.
Yeah, that's the link.
That's
why I would say it seems to me that it's reasonable based upon recorded experience, not that we have that experience ourselves, we're separated from it by 2,000 years, but we have an accurate record of the recording of their experience regarding his appearance to 500 people or more. And I want to do one story here. Go ahead and let me hear.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, when we're talking about self-possible versus the noumenal, when you can take a cultural context into that as well, because culture is somewhat noumenal from anthropology standpoint. You know, we do certain things because we've been acculturated to do them. And I think that using historical records, which we have no direct knowledge of, I think that's outside of Kant's definition of personal experience.
Oh, it is. Yeah.
And
right.
Also, I think that, you know, and if you're taking a historical context like that, 500 people, I mean, those people could have been, you know, coerced. They could have been acculturated to believe a certain thing. I mean, we don't have the direct knowledge to say if it's the truth or not.
I think that I would disagree with that. I think that we have an abundance, we have an embarrassment of riches when it comes to the witness of the, we don't have the original autographs, but we do have copies and copies of copies of those to the extent that we have roughly 1,000% more evidence than we have for Suetonius. And when you take into account geographical distribution, when you take into account genealogical solidarity, when you take into account the enormous congruence of witnesses across many, many years, the argument to me goes toward, and the fact that these men from extra-biblical sources gave up their lives, these are the apostles themselves, gave up their lives in defense of someone who they knew hadn't really risen from the dead. I don't believe that a man does that. If you give up your life for, well, give me an example.
Socrates, soldiers in World War II.
Yeah,
terrorists killing themselves.
Well, the point is though that the people that are claiming to have seen Jesus rise from the dead, if they knew in fact that he had not, why would they die? Why would they allow themselves to be martyred? Why not run?
Because the story wouldn't be any good.
Yeah, that's true.
Hello?
Yes.
My question is, to your point, why people do things. We don't know why people do things. In fact, in a lot of law courts, eyewitness testimonies are no longer to be considered absolute. That's because people do things. There's a case where the lady claimed the boyfriend raped her.
Sure.
Why did she do that? We don't know. So why would people testify to the death of Jesus? To the own ego? We don't know. So the record is not absolute as to whether those people actually watched. In fact, the record is not even sure that such a record exists. So I'm not even sure those that the evidence that you point out is there.
I mean, there's a lot of scholars out there have documented that existence of those evidence are trivial.
There is a, I mean, if we subject the evidence in the manuscripts that we have,
and scholars have looked at that, many of them have done that.
Yeah, I agree. And there are a lot of those scholars who have looked at over 5,900 manuscripts of the New Testament alone, and ostraca, different forms of the manuscript. How can we explain?
Break it to two camps. Most historical professors and anthropology professors are usually saying the negative, whereas the theologians are the ones who are saying that records exist. I'm not sure you can bridge that gap.
Oh, sure you can. The records are there. I mean, the physical evidence is there. What are you going to do with the physical evidence of the more manuscripts we find, the better the evidence grows.
Actually, the more manuscripts you find, the more mistakes people have found.
No, that's not true.
The other. If
that's
the original record, it's a false testimony.
Oh, goodness. Where's your evidence for that?
That it's absolutely false. So there's no way you can prove the original. So if you cannot prove the original, there's no way you can prove the validity.
Let's go.
Okay.
Yeah.
You want to go first?
No, you're up.
I just like, can you hear me out there?
You bet.
Just like to get just some references. John Meyer, a marginal Jew, and N.T. Wright's another good scholar, Rabbi Jacob Neusner, and Bart Ehrman, who's now, after he wrote God's Problem, he's an agnostic atheist, but I emailed Bart Ehrman and asked him what he thought about John Meyer, a marginal Jew who's a Catholic priest in Notre Dame. He said John Meyer is a real item because he just lets the chips fall where they may. And he throws out some of, he doesn't throw out the baby with the bathwater, but he does really good scripture scholarship. And when you read John Meyer, you'll see it's like reading Frederick Copelstein, a real scholar.
Yeah.
So I just refer you to John Meyer, N.T. Wright, and Raymond Brown, The Birth and Death of the Messiah, who shows that Joseph of Arimathea did take the bodies down. They weren't left to be eaten by birds. And there were specific tombs that Joseph of Arimathea knew about to put the three bodies in.
I was just curious that you would talk about how Kant referred to man as not inherently evil. What was the phrase you used?
Radically evil.
And yet, he talked about the importance of experience, and that's how we have our knowledge. And so, how would Kant reconcile those two, that man is radically evil, but suggests that there's just an inherent evil outside of experience that's inherent within man. And how would you reconcile? How would Kant reconcile that?
I don't know that he ever did reconcile it. He admitted on the one, or suggested on the one hand that man is radically evil, and on the other hand, in the Second Critique and in Morals, I think, he argued for he doesn't use this term, but it's kind of like a divine light, that there's a presence within each autonomous person that can generate the desire when the perceiver becomes aware of the example of Jesus or the example of God, that it awakens that in the person so that the person is then made capable of doing good works and overcoming the evil impulse. So the evil impulse is, I mean, it's as close to original sin, I think, as we can get in Kant, where he says that all men, all women are infected with this, and in order to overcome that, they have to have a vision of the one that is the archetype of the ideal man, and that's Jesus, although he never mentions it. He's in his argument.
That infection from outside of experience, though?
I do not know. I do not know if experience leads the person to it, or if the person has an innate evil that works itself out in experience. I don't know which way he goes. I don't remember. I don't think I've read that.
I'd like to throw a question here. Kant says that man is radically evil. Okay, well, you can point to any number of people who are not Christians and not spiritual necessarily who live good lives. They make good moral decisions on a daily basis. Mm. And there are good examples, and even better examples than some people who claim to be enlightened. How can you say that they are radically evil?
Isaiah has a verse that says all our righteousness, it's an admitted good works, all of our good things that we do are as unto the Lord as filthy rags. And what that says is that despite the fact that we are sin-tainted, according to Christian worldview, that we have an inherent sin nature, that we are still capable of doing good things, but those good things do not earn us a right relationship with God. That's only through a belief in His atoning sacrifice in the person of Christ. So in the Old Testament, when they were doing the sacrificial system, that anticipated the ultimate sacrifice in the person of His Son. So that the right relationship with God, which allows us to transform those good works into works that are acceptable before God, takes place through faith in the person of Christ.
Okay, so a six-year-old girl who likes to play with dolls and please her mother is radically evil.
She has a sin nature just as much as anyone else. However, there is, my point of view is that the blood of Christ on the cross atones for children, the unborn children who have not reached an age where they can be morally accountable before God to make a conscious decision to yield to that evil impulse. So I would say that the blood of Christ... Beg your pardon?
What part of the Bible is that supposed to be in?
It's a theological argument. There is I think in Romans he makes a good case for the atoning work of Christ in covering the sins of those who cannot believe.
Just a comment. It's fascinating that this view is built into the structure of all American institutions.
Which view is that? The concert?
Good and evil.
Uh-huh.
Jefferson believed all men were created equal. Adams believed all men were created evil. And that still exists in America, and it suffuses our entire political and institutional and cultural structure.
So let me hear you again now. You said Jefferson equal. Did you say Adams evil?
Adams believed all men were created evil. Jefferson believed all men were created good.
Okay.
Therefore, government that governed least was best. And for Adams, government had to regulate in order to control evil and create liberty in a stable society. Those conflicts have never been resolved in this country.
It sounds like a Kant with his thing about the inside of the person coming out and when it comes out to Jesus. It sounds like he was right up to being saved, but didn't want to say it.
He didn't believe in the vicarious nature of atonement. That Jesus died and through his death that he took care of, paid the price for all of our sins. He believed that each man was responsible for living out a good life, but not as contingent, not as depending on God, that there was something within each man that allowed him to live out that good life, as long as that spark was awakened by a view of Jesus as a good example. That's why Kant is Pelagian.
Interesting how close he got.
Yeah, he's very close. Yeah.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Hands right behind him.
Any more questions?
Comments? All right, thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.